It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, for more than a decade, debate has raged over whether or not Pluto is a planet. It was downgraded to a dwarf planet in 2006, but now some researchers say, nope, bring it back. It is a planet. A UW astronomer joins the show coming up. First, Wisconsin's backlog of more than 4,000 sexual assault evidence kits has now been cleared. Attorney General Brad Schimmel said this morning that some of the kits date back to the 1980s. He launched a project in 2016 to test all of them and vowed to have it finished by the end of the year.
Today's milestone is very significant, but this work is about much more than just testing kits. It's about bringing justice for survivors. It's about preventing future crimes. And it's about changing the culture around responding to sexual assault.
Schimmel is up for re-election this fall. He's being challenged by Democrat Josh Call, who's been highly critical of Schimmel for the amount of time it's taken to complete testing. Schimmel says that it took time to inventory everything and find private labs to analyze them. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, let's talk about this backlog. These were evidence samples that had been collected from victims over years. And then what? Many of them sat there.
Right. So these untested sexual assault kits were sitting in police departments and hospitals all across the state of Wisconsin. And this huge backlog of kits, it was about 6,800, I believe, was first discovered by former Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen in 2014. And the state has since then been working, some might say too slowly, to gather those kits from these places across the state and get them tested.
And do we have a sense of why, at least why many of these weren't tested until now?
Well, there's a variety of reasons. This is something that reporters in Wisconsin have been keeping track of since they sort of came onto the radar in 2014. And that was something that happened because a number of other states discovered these backlogs kind of scattered around the state. So Wisconsin went searching for them and found them. And there were a number of obstacles. So first of all, the state had to get all the kits from the places where they were, inventory them, and then the state crime lab, which some people may be familiar, has been pretty slammed in recent years with more DNA testing, drug testing, things like that. So figuring out how to test all these kits, these thousands of kits that showed up, was a challenge, and there were different ideas about how to do that. The current attorney general wanted to get a grant to send these kits to private labs. And it took a while to get that grant funding and then identify the right labs and get them sent out.
Has it been the case that people have said, hey, these untested kits mean that, perpetrators may go not found, not prosecuted?
That's right. That's been a big concern. A lot of Democrats have been pushing back on Schimmel, citing that concern. The state Democratic Party put out a statement today, and the Democrat that's running against Schimmel in the attorney general's race, that's Josh Call, put out a statement as well saying, you know, it's taken years to get these thousands of kits tested. And in those years, there have been, potentially violent criminals still out on the streets because they haven't been identified.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about the announcement from the State Department of Justice that the backlog of sexual assault evidence kits, the backlog in testing those has been cleared. They've caught up now, it sounds like. Laurel, this problem, as you were saying earlier, has been years in the making. It goes back way before Brad Schimmel was Attorney General or even his predecessor. Is that right?
That's right. So I think the oldest kit that they identified in 2014 when they discovered this backlog was from 1984. So this is something that has been certainly building over the last few decades. And they did, as I mentioned before, identify about 6,800 kits. Of those 6,800, they decided to test about 4,000. Now, they didn't test all of them for a variety of reasons. They did kind of an individual analysis of the case, of the risks, what they knew about the victim and what had evolved since then in some of those cases. So they certainly didn't test all the ones that they found. But those 4,000 kits that they began testing in 2016, after they got that grant funding, took about 2 years to get done.
Did the Attorney General of the Department of Justice today say that they'd gotten outcomes from these tests that might lead to, I don't know, future investigations.
Yeah, that's the goal, right? I mean, they're bringing in all of this new information, a real wealth of information now, and they're hoping to use it, obviously, to go after some cases that have been out there for quite a while. So they're talking about reopening some cases. Some cases are currently open. They don't need to be reopened, but they have this new information. So we don't have a lot of concrete evidence right now, as of cases we can point to saying this came from the backlog. I think over the course of the past couple years, as these tests have been coming in, there have been sort of a smattering of those cases. I remember an article I read on this, I think, highlighted just three sometime late last year. So there hasn't been a huge rush of those new individuals that have been convicted or anything yet, but I think that's certainly the goal.
Now, this is the backlog, and of course, unfortunately, there will be new crimes and new evidence kits out there. Has this whole experience changed the way police departments and the state deal with new sexual assault evidence kits?
Yes, it has. And I think the extent to which the state has changed its practices is sort of up for political debate as to whether they've done enough, right? So some of the things that the Attorney General has pointed out and is, I think, pretty proud of is the fact that you can track sexual assault kits online now. That's going to be something that's available to victims so they can see in what stage their testing is. So there's some more transparency and accountability there. The Attorney General has also looked to get some more training for law enforcement in how to interact with sexual assault victims to make sure that this process is being handled in, you know, in a sensitive, professional and expedient way. Other people, political opponents to the Attorney General, certainly Democrats who have voiced concern about this whole process, have been pushing for even more funding for the state crime lab. So the state crime lab doesn't need to outsource some of this testing, so they can do it in-house, not sending to those private labs out of state. And I think that that's a political debate that we're going to see continue in this issue.
As you've mentioned a couple times, Laura, in addition to concerns about the punishment of perpetrators and concerns about victims, this has been a political issue. Is this going to stop being a political issue with today's announcement, or do you see this still playing a role between now and November elections?
Oh, definitely not. I mean, I think definitely not. It won't stop. I think that this is something that we're going to continue to hear about in this Attorney General's race. It's been something that's been a major focus for Attorney General Schimmel. The media has been kind of keeping track of him, and as he's offered updates on the sexual assault kit testing, sort of justifying delays or going about it the way that he wants to go about it, which has faced criticism from some. I think that his Democratic opponent is going to continue to bring up the ways in which he would have handled it differently in terms of, you know, more state funding. Or I think that's a primary, the state funding is a primary argument, as well as just general ways that they could have been more expeditious in this testing. That's the biggest criticism of Schimmel, is just this wasn't done fast enough.
We'll leave it there for now. Laurel, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. We talked with her about Attorney General Brad Schimmel's announcement that the Department of Justice has finished testing a backlog of about 4,000 sexual assault evidence kits. First, back in 2006, the International Astronomical Union knocked Pluto off its perch as the ninth planet in our solar system, downgrading it to a dwarf planet. At the time, the IAU argued that Pluto didn't have what it took to be a planet, and some astronomers have taken apparent glee in its demotion. Here's Neil deGrasse Tyson talking to Stephen Colbert.
Pluto had it coming from the beginning. It was never really belong. Pluto's orbit crosses that of another planet. That's no kind of behavior for a planet. No.
You got to stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane.
All right, okay.
No.
Now,
our moon has five times the mass of Pluto. So just get over it.
Was our moon a planet?
No. It's a moon.
It was a controversial move at the time, dividing astronomers, everyday space fans, elementary school students in particular, and more. And the debate was rekindled this week after a group of researchers argued that, yeah, Pluto does meet their definition of a planet. Jim Lattice joins us now. He teaches astronomy at the UW-Madison College of Letters and Science and is the director of the UW Space Place. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, you think that maybe this argument, as I understand it, isn't really that productive, arguing about whether or not we want to call Pluto a planet.
Yeah, I guess I would say that it doesn't seem like it is productive in the sense that it gets people talking about these things.
Yeah.
And that's been a major defense in the wake of the IAU discussion that, well, there's more good than bad out of this or whatever. So I'm OK with that. Sure, if we talk about that sort of thing. But what you see people doing is what we just heard Neil deGrasse Tyson doing, is tossing out, well, here's the criteria that I think an object ought to meet in order to be worthy of this title. And it's great to talk about what these objects are, but the labels are arbitrary and bound to shift anyway with our growing knowledge. That's what we see happening here, is with increasing knowledge of the solar system, language has to sort of adapt to that. But it really ought to be a technical language, not a changing how people talk in the streets and at home sort of thing.
Right. There's not really an official registry of solar system planets that you fight for the honor of being on, is there?
Well, I mean, it sometimes sounds like that. We talk about, you know, the demotion of Pluto or something along that line, like we're making judgments like these things have earned awards that we're now depriving them of or something. But this is, of course, not what's going on at all.
Now, as humans, we do love to define things and categorize. What are some of the definitions we're playing with when we talk about what a planet is versus a comet or versus a satellite?
Right. Well, so these sorts of things do come down to looking at ways that we can distinguish one thing from another. And it used to be that anything that wasn't a star or a comet in the sky was a planet, because it moved around. The sun and the moon were considered planets at one time. So, but. Once again, reflecting increasing knowledge of these sorts of things, you start to say, well, the sun doesn't really fit. After Copernicanism, the sun not only doesn't fit physically, but it's not moving around. In fact, it's us that's doing the moving around. And suddenly the Earth, which was not a planet, now is a planet. So the way we use these terms certainly shifts with our knowledge, and that's a good thing. What we have right now is that sort of a planet, well, it's not a star, but it is orbiting around a star. That is, it can't be big enough that it could give off its own light. So it's less massive than a certain amount. It's got to be orbiting around a star, and it has to be large enough to be spherical. Has to have enough gravitational self-interaction to be a spherical body. And then the condition that the IAU put on there, these were pretty much accepted sorts of criteria that I just mentioned, but then they added on there that it has to have exercise some sort of gravitational dominance around its orbit. And that kind of rules out the asteroids, no one of which is, say, dominant. And that's how it kind of ruled out Pluto, because it's not as Tyson was just saying, it has a very tiny mass out there. It doesn't exercise any sort of dominant influence either. But that's a very mushy kind of criterion to talk about. What does it mean? That term was never defined. What does it mean for it to be dominant?
And scientifically speaking, if we say these things are a category, or in a category we're going to call planet, are there things in common among them where we can compare and contrast, where it's useful to have this category and to know whether or not we include something like Pluto out there or Ceres in the asteroid belt?
Well, yeah, certainly, because having meaningful categories like this is really important in most branches of science, as we know. If we think of it a little bit like a natural history kind of science, like geology or botany or something along that line, where terminologies are really important, categories are really important for scientists to exchange information about these things. You know, you discover some flower in Africa somewhere and you want to compare it to other known, already known things. And these categories help you organize your knowledge and understand what you have before you. And that kind of thing does have to be established. That's why people have to get degrees in botany or something along that line. So it would be perfectly fine for astronomers, it would probably be important for astronomers to have some sort of coherent taxonomy of planets and things. So the way to go about that, though, is not by redefining common words like planet or something along that line, but to generate one. There is a problem there, and that is that we only have one example of a solar system in front of us right now.
Now, when I was a kid, of course, I learned the nine planets, and I memorized them with a mnemonic device. That's one way to learn stuff. Is it maybe more interesting to teach kids about the planets by saying, well, here's eight, and then here's Pluto, and here's the debate about it? I mean, is that maybe going to be more educational in some ways?
Oh, given that situation, of course, you can use it for educational purposes. I don't know that it's any more valuable than some other classification that you would also.
Sure.
I mean, we've talked for years about the giant planets and the so-called terrestrial planets, things that are really large and massive and predominantly volatile elements, and things that are a lot less massive and predominantly refractory. We can break these things down any number of different ways. But the what we really need is a lot more knowledge of planets. Again, that's what's happening as this Kuiper Belt, as the population and the character of this whole Kuiper Belt business, of which Pluto and Charon are just members of. That's really what broke the threshold, so to speak, here, is that Pluto is not just the single thing out there, but a member of a group. And so defining it as a member of this group is kind of the direction that things were going. But I don't think it's particularly useful to just to move Pluto into another category for pedagogical purposes.
Talking to Jim Lattice from the UW-Madison, the UW Space Place, UW-Madison College of Letters and Science, astronomy teacher as well. Jim, there's a lot of fun news coming out lately about Pluto, some great new images in particular. What do we know now about Pluto that we didn't say 3 years ago?
Well, almost everything. We knew so little about Pluto, and I think this is also powering a certain amount of this attempt to rehabilitate it as a planet or whatever. But certainly, it's turning out to be active in a way that people really didn't expect. You would find an active body that far out in the solar system. The general kind of presumption, and that's really all it was, was that far out, so it's got to be so cold, it's probably just this frozen lump of stuff that hasn't changed since it formed, practically. But in fact, these things have turned, they're currently active, and they interact with each other. These bodies interact with each other in ways that produce really interesting and completely unseen anywhere else topographies on the planet, and chemistries, even, that we have no experience of. So that's all really wonderful, stuff. And we need to know more about bodies like that to understand the formation of the solar system.
Yeah, what unanswered questions? I assume these images raised a whole bunch of questions about Pluto and maybe the Kuiper Belt, too. What do we know now that we didn't know, or what do we want to know next, I should say?
Well, gosh, with Pluto, there's going to be a long agenda, but that's really true of most of the outer solar system, where we've had only very isolated glimpses of them, and that's an extreme case in the case of Pluto, where the New Horizons spacecraft, you know, just flew by there, and there's no chance to take a second look. Oh, you know, let's look at that more closely. Well, too late. You've flown by already, and you're not going back. So it's a difficult, it's a particularly difficult case, but there's a huge amount of stuff. I mean, the internal structure of that planet is unknown. The ability to tell its history, we have enough information from some of it to talk about the history of interactions with other bodies, things like cratering and the renewal of its surface and things like that, but not enough to go back and generalize better. So, yeah, more looks at it would be really important, but they're going to be hard to get.
And I see headlines, I don't know how legit these are, the idea that astronomers are searching for a different ninth planet, that they think that there's gravitational evidence, but we can't see it.
Right. Well, that's a case where if there was a single object explaining what they basically are is statistical patterns in the orbits of Kuiper Belt objects. And you could imagine a random distribution of orbits, but then we find patterns within the distribution that aren't random, and so you look for an organizing principle. What could have influenced this tendency to, say, align the planet, these orbits in certain ways? And a massive planet out there could do it, but there's no known, but none of the known planets could do it. So yeah, the inference is maybe there's something. In fact, a really good theory is that there's something much more massive out there.
Now, it's amazing. We keep hearing reports of finding exoplanets or evidence of planets in other solar systems, which is cool, but there's so much we don't know about our neighbors here still.
Right, but we're going to know more about our neighbors by studying these other examples, too. I mean, that's always the case. And in particular, just to go back to the Pluto discussion, mm-hmm. we don't have any information about planets or whatever objects, whatever we would call them, low-mass objects in other solar systems. The exoplanet population is entirely a population of planets typically as massive as the Earth, but usually way more massive than that. So something as small as a Kuiper belt structure or something like that, that's almost undetectable at the moment around other stars.
Briefly, as we wrap up, whatever we call Pluto, are you hoping that the talk about it gets people looking up and thinking about what's going on in our solar system?
Well, yeah. I mean, of course, that's part of what I do. And it has, at that level, it has succeeded in that, although I think we wouldn't have had to have the debate about planet or not planet. The New Horizons, the stuff we actually know about it is way more important than what we call it. And that's all wonderful stuff. And of course, I welcome that possibility, that conversation.
Jim, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
Jim Lattice teaches astronomy at the UW-Madison College of Letters and Science and is director of the UW Space Place. He joined us today to talk about Pluto. Some researchers now saying we should call it a planet. After about a decade ago, we said we shouldn't. He says it doesn't matter what we call it. It's pretty cool. First, it's never been easier to see a documentary, regardless of where you live. Netflix has played a big role in pushing the genre forward with documentary series like the popular Making a Murderer and full-length films. Hulu is making strides as well. And a few documentaries have found success on the big screen this summer, like Won't You Be My Neighbor, an ode to children's show star Mr. Rogers. The documentary is no longer just for cinephiles and history buffs. Nick Shager is a film critic and culture writer. His work appears in publications like Yahoo Entertainment, The Daily Beast, Esquire, and more. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, I've seen some people out there, Nick, making the case that we're in maybe some kind of golden age for documentaries with different outlets picking them up. Do you see that?
I do. I think we are in a great moment right this year and even last year. And that is both because of a relationship between the theaters and the streaming services, which, you know, has only just started to flourish. Documentaries, I think, had a big moment in the early 2000s and then sort of tapered off a bit theatrically. But the streaming services have stepped in to, you know, sort of bolster that by releasing a whole slew of both feature-length documentaries as well as TV series. And that, in turn, has, I think, reignited interest in documentaries to the point that now we're seeing them make a comeback at the box office, which we've seen certainly this summer, thanks to films like RBG and Won't You Be My Neighbor.
Were documentaries for a while there a hard sell, given that, you know, they might be on only so many screens, there's a lot of competition for real estate in theaters? Was it just hard for documentary filmmakers to get money to see the light of day?
I think it has to do with, the demand versus the number of theaters that are playing them. I think across the country, we've seen a dwindling or a number of art houses increasingly closed down in competition, you know, boxed out by the competition from multiplexes and the major studio releases. I'm located here in New York City, and we've just had one of our most prominent art houses that has spearheaded art house cinema for decades close down. I think as a result, it was very hard to get a documentary to not only play in a theater, but to stay in a theater, because there have been a number of documentaries vying for a very small number of screens. Now, however, we're seeing that there's some sort of revival there, as I said, because I think streaming services have given people a taste of a wide variety of documentaries, and that in turn has shown that there is still an appetite for it if you can get the right documentary out there on the right number of screens.
out documentary films never went away. And some people had big success, like Michael Moore since the 90s, Morgan Spurlock, the Super Size Me and his follow-ups to that, Errol Morris and others. But did those big high-profile successes kind of bring the documentary genre along with them in those days?
I think that, you know, Michael Moore in the late 90s and early 2000s, along with Jeffrey Blitz, who made a documentary called Spellbound about a spelling bee competition, and as you said, Morgan Spurlock with Super Size Me, really spearheaded a mainstreaming of documentary cinema. Those were really sort of pop-oriented documentaries. They had wide appeal. They had very easy, sort of catchy premises to bring audiences in. But the problem there is sort of Michael Moore and Morgan Spurlock are very big personalities themselves, and they were sort of part of what helped sell those films. It was hard for a lot of other documentaries to sort of match that. And I think what you wound up was having a situation where, at least in terms of box office and in terms of wide appeal, documentaries sort of tapered off a bit. Until now, we've seen, this year in particular, if you can get a documentary into a theater with a big personality, say Mr. Rogers or Ruth Bader Ginsburg, audiences are really interested in seeing personalities that they know and that they love and seeing really in-depth nonfiction portraits of them.
For those movies maybe without that big personality, are the streaming services helping them find their audience and vice versa, the audience you know, that might not have been able to go to a big city to see it on the two screens it was on, now they can find that more specialized documentary?
Absolutely. Netflix, Amazon, and Hulu have been enormous in terms of getting a wide variety of documentaries out to an amazingly large audience. As you said, people who don't live in New York and L.A., don't have nearly the options, even in theaters, for documentaries as others. And so you wind up with a situation where Netflix, the documentaries just show up on your television, you know, on a given Friday. That really has allowed the streaming services to cater to a wide audience by doing a number of different types of things, including, as we've seen, especially with Netflix, true crime, which is, has just been an enormous draw for them and has, I think, really sort of helped reignite interest in documentaries in general over the last 2-3 years.
We're talking to Nick Shager, film critic and culture writer. He is telling us about the rise, the rebirth in some ways of documentaries in the age of streaming services. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen a good documentary lately, a new one, or maybe an older one that you want to share a recommendation for? Where do you go to find documentaries? Have you gotten into them or back into them lately? Call 800-642-1234. Nick, you wrote a piece for Esquire, the best 10 documentaries of 2018 so far. Tell us a couple that are at the top of your list.
Yeah, the top of my list is a film, actually, that's sort of a documentary hybrid called 24 Frames. It's by a world-famous Iranian director named Abbas Kiarostami. He passed away a couple of years ago, and this was his final film. It is a series of actually 24 still photos that he sort of brings to life in animated form. It's a really beautiful, sort of challenging meditation on mortality and on the cinema itself. My other one, number two on my list, is Film Worker, which is a totally different type of film. It is a portrait of a man named Leon Vitali, who for decades was Stanley Kubrick's right-hand man. And so the film is both this fascinating study of sort of the genius behind the genius, and also a study in obsession and what that can do to you when you dedicate your entire life to somebody else's vision. Both of those are a little out of the ordinary. So is my number three film, Bisbee 17, which is a fascinating documentary that just came out about a tragedy that took place in Bisbee, Arizona in 1917 that involves a lot of issues having to do with immigration and intolerance that are make it a very relevant story today. Those coupled with, as we've said, the big hits, Won't You Be My Neighbor, and RBG, also a film called Minding the Gap, which was out on Hulu recently. All of those films are really great. It really has made it a banner year for documentaries.
And those and others on your list really highlight the diversity of documentaries. Because I think when people hear documentary, or I'll speak for myself, when I hear documentary, I think, oh, it's something that's going to focus in on one issue or one period of history, or maybe it's a biography. And it sounds like you're saying there's a lot of range here in terms of a form, experimentation on some of these, and content. There's just a lot more going on out there.
There is. There's really a wide variety. The films we've been talking about that are the big hits of the summer are Won't You Be My Neighbor, RBG, and another documentary called Three Identical Strangers, all of which have really great mainstream appeal because they have great personalities at their center, or they have great, fascinating real-life stories that, you know, are sort of almost like page-turners in a certain sense. Three Identical Strangers plays almost like a thriller in certain regards and a mystery. At the same time, there are a lot of other films out there that do challenge the form and do sort of unique things with them. And I don't think, you know, documentary filmmakers and documentary fans have to necessarily settle for them. These films, a lot of them wind up on your streaming services. A film like Minding the Gap, which is on Hulu. It's a Hulu documentary original. It's about three young kids who grew up in Rockford, Illinois as skateboarders. And their story is this fascinating story that eventually winds up being a story not only about economic disadvantages, but about sort of a domestic abuse. And so there's a really wide variety. And the great thing about documentaries is it gives you this amazingly diverse view of life itself. And so, you know, this year in particular has proven that to be the case.
Let's give a listen to the trailer from the one you were just talking about, Minding the Gap. Three teenage boys from Illinois find their sense of self and family in skateboarding.
Take one.
I'm making this film because I saw myself in your story.
I always felt like I didn't fit in with my family.
My parents ran this very controlling house. I ran away a lot.
Skateboarding is more of a family than my family.
How did you get disciplined?
I mean, well, they call it child abuse now, but...
Life might be moving too fast.
We have to fully grow up, and it's gonna suck.
When you're a kid, you just do. You just act. And then somewhere along the line, everyone loses that.
It's one of the things that documentaries can do, Nick, maybe take these characters who might be stock characters in everyday life. Oh, there's some kids skateboarding, and look at the world through their point of view.
Yeah, there's a real nuance to documentary filmmaking when it's done at its finest that really is sort of almost unparalleled when you have real access to these unique individuals, even though they seem like kids you've seen a million times before in a million movies or seen in your community or seen on your streets. You know, a film like Minding the Gap really lets you in to not only see their home lives and their personal relationships, but gets a sense of their interior lives. And, it, you know, when done at its finest, a film like Minding the Gap is really, you know, illuminating for not just a specific person or people, but about the human condition in general.
We're talking to film critic Nick Shager. We're talking about the rising popularity and availability now of documentaries. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you new to documentary watching? What's one you've watched and liked, maybe would recommend? What makes a documentary interesting to you? And has a streaming of some sort, a Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, whatever, exposed you to more documentaries? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Nick Shager, a film critic and culture writer whose work appears in The Daily Beast, Esquire, Yahoo Entertainment, and more, talking about documentary movies and their journey to mainstream success and their availability on streaming services and how that's changing the game. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you watch documentaries? What are you looking for? What are you recommending? Call in or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Shia is with us in Madison. Shia, hi.
Hi. I tuned in to Central Time right at the right moment, getting ready for a new season of On Wisconsin locally in Madison. So, you know, I got roped into filmmaking myself with a small film crew here, and it's really expanding out here. And, you know, I'm working on a documentary myself, and I never thought I'd be a filmmaker. But this Get Loud International Artists on Board documentary expose is going to be a really cool one. And what inspired me is I was looking for a film to watch, and I went to Four Star Video and just checked out, you know, I just like the title of it, Something Ventured, and I put it in, and, you know, it's this documentary about the original venture capitalists and, like, this small group of people that, you know, went to fund, you know, just little companies, Cisco, IBM, Apple, I don't know, Atari, you know, but it was all these, like, you know, it was just this idea of people allying their skills together.
I gotcha, Shia. Your phone line's breaking up a little bit, but Shia is going into making a documentary himself, Nick, and he mentioned a long-time Wisconsin video store. There are still video stores out there. How important were they in keeping documentaries alive over the years?
I think they were vital at the time because, like many other sort of smaller genres, so to speak, they had the same amount of visibility on the shelves. One of the things that happened with the disappearance of video stores, at least initially, was there was no way to really get them in front of people or to make people, well, you know, aware that they existed. I think that has now changed with the streaming services because everybody can just log on and go search under, you know, the documentary categories, and that really aids things. But we had a period there in between the end of video stores and the real rise of streaming here, where people were renting things over Netflix, you know, by disc, you know, through the mail, and that was a much harder way to discover things than it is today.
Shia, thanks for the call. Good luck with your own documentary effort. I will go now to Jim in Rhinelander. Jim, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I watched two documentaries probably last year on Netflix. I enjoyed both of them. The first one was called Valley Uprising, and it was about the whole climbing culture in the Yosemite Valley. Even though I don't climb, I found it fascinating. So it started with the original group probably in the 50s when it became popular, and it followed the whole activity up until the modern era. I think this was done in like 2015 maybe. So it was really fascinating. I can't believe some of the stuff these guys do nowadays. And the other one that I really enjoyed, it was called Damnation, and it was a documentary on some of the high-profile dams that have been, you know, installed on our river systems in the country and the negative impacts they are having on the resource and what they took away from the native people as far as their fishing grounds and things like that. It was a very interesting documentary and well worth the watch.
Jim, thanks for the call. Valley Uprising and Damnation are his recommendations. And Nick, he found those on Netflix. And I imagine with the algorithms and whatnot, once you start liking one documentary, that's going to start exposing you to more, right?
Absolutely. In an ideal situation, the more you watch of a given genre, the more the algorithm should find other things for you. And certainly I know from my own experience, watching a lot of true crime on Netflix, half of the selections Netflix shows me now are other true crime things. So it should work.
Jim, thanks for the call. Go next to Jerry with us in Glendale. Jerry, hi.
Good afternoon. All of us are looking forward to September 21st when Fahrenheit 9/11 is going to be released. We're great big fans of Michael Moore in the Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha area. He had his second debut of Roger and Me in Kenosha. And I'd just like to know from the guest if he's seen it. And then I'd like to get the name of that arts house that closed in New York City and where, what borough or neighborhood it might be in.
Jerry, thanks for the call. The new one is Fahrenheit 11/9 by Michael Moore, right, Nick?
That's right. Yeah, that's it's going to be the sort of companion piece to Fahrenheit 9/11, which was obviously about the Bush administration back in 2004. Fahrenheit 11/9 is specifically about Donald Trump's presidency and the 2016 election that led to it. That has just premiered at the Toronto Film Festival. Unfortunately, I'm not at the Toronto Film Festival, so I've yet to see it. I know there's been a mixed reaction to it, but then there usually is a mixed reaction to Michael Moore films. As for the art house that closed here, it was Lincoln Plaza Cinemas, which was the Upper West Side epicenter of art house cinema here in New York City. It just closed a couple of months ago, and I believe they are working on getting somebody else to take over the operation of an art house up there, but so far, nothing doing.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to film critic Nick Shager about the state of documentaries these days. Want to go back to one that was on your list, one of the bigger hits now, the one on Mr. Rogers. Here's a listen to that trailer.
A television program for children made its unauspicious debut on station WQED in Pittsburgh. Its host, Fred Rogers.
Mr. Rogers?
Yeah.
I want to tell you something.
What would you like to tell
me? I like you.
I like you, my dear. Thank you very much for telling me that.
You take all of the elements that make good television and do the exact opposite. You have Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Low production values, simple set, unlikely star. Yet it worked.
Hello.
I've always felt that I didn't need to put on a funny hat or jump through the hoop to have a relationship with a child.
So what is it in 2018, Nick, do you think that's making a Mr. Rogers documentary such a hit?
I think Mr. Rogers and Won't You Be My Neighbor has been the beneficiary of not only all the things we've been talking about, but of timing. I do think that there has been, it is proven that there is an appetite out there for films that are run counter to the daily news cycle, which has been, I think, wearying for a lot of people over the last year or two. And here we have, and not just wearying, but very divisive. There's been a lot of anger. There's been a lot of conflict. I think here you have a documentary that is not only about somebody everybody grew up with and loved, but somebody whose story is really a celebration of goodness and the value of goodness and kindness and compassion, not just on an individual level, but on a cultural level. And that has really resounded. I mean, the movie has made over $22 million at the box office, which for a documentary is really unheard of. So clearly it's speaking to something, some sort of need that moviegoers were looking for.
And Nick, before we run out of time, you mentioned that you watch a fair amount of true crime documentaries. Do you have one you would point people toward who want to check out that genre of documentary?
I do. I think that if people are looking at our Netflix subscribers, there's a wealth of choices. But one that really stood out this year and that just won an Emmy in the last day or two is a series called Wild Wild Country. It is a story about an Indian sort of cult that appeared in the Pacific Northwest in 1981 and sort of tried to take over the region and wound up getting into a big fight with the local community and then the state government and city government. It's a fascinating story. It's one that I didn't know about, even though I certainly lived through it. And I think it winds up getting into a lot of issues that are still relevant today while also providing you with a really fascinating portrait of not just sort of out there religious groups, but it has in this woman named Ma Anand Sheela, the second in command of the cult, a really fascinating sort of villain for people to really root against.
We'll leave it there for now. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Nick Shager, film critic and culture writer. You can check out more of his top picks in his piece for Esquire. It's called The Best Documentaries of 2018 so far. We've been talking about the rebirth in some ways of documentaries. Twenty-five years ago today, the truth was out there. The X-Files and its haunting theme song made a TV debut on this day in 1993. J. Carl L. Larson, producer of Central Time, you became a fan of the show.
Yeah, I became a fan of the show as an adult versus as a child, because I remember when the show came out and I remember it terrifying me.
I mean, just the song is pretty creepy.
Yeah, even sitting here, I had like this moment of like, I don't like this, but I became a big fan of the show once I was older.
Now, what is it that appealed to you? I mean, at the time, there were a lot of conspiracy theories out there. Hey, we're back there again.
I mean, I think when I was a kid, the thing that scared me the most were the aliens, especially because I grew up, you know, in Nevada near Air 50. Well, not near, but in
literally in Area 51.
Area 51. Surprise, that's where I'm from. but, you know, as I got older, I just got really interested in, you know, the kind of creepiness. But also it ended up being kind of a funny show, too, at times. So
I remember a favorite episode was kind of one of the wackier ones. There are Twin Peaks references. And then there are men in black who happen to look exactly like Alex Trebek and Jesse Ventura, played by Alex Trebek and Jesse Ventura. That was peak X-Files for me.
Yeah, I liked the doppelgangers episode where things went wrong every time doppelgangers were near each other.
All right, celebrating X-Files. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.